Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. It is pretty cold and dark and we are heading towards holiday festive Christmas time. Whether you celebrate or not, it's still, I guess, a lot of time people sort of get together with their families. So I know it's difficult for people at this time of year. I just want to say I've been sharing on Instagram and Twitter some resources, and I know Julia Samuel, Saint Julia, as we say on the show, has been sharing some really good resources on Instagram as well. It's also National Grief Awareness Week. If you're listening, then you're aware of grief. Like, you don't need to be made aware of it. But if you're looking for good resources, good events, the Good Grief Trust have been running some stuff this week. And so, yeah, just check out. We're at The Griefcast on Instagram and Twitter, and I'll be sharing some things on there as well. This week, I'm talking to an extraordinary person. I know I say that every week, but my goodness, this woman is amazing. She is the writer Hilma Wolitzer. She has a new book called Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket, which is a collection of her stories, which she's been writing since the late 60s. Because Hilma, and I feel like this is relevant because she's a very impressive person. And she is 91, which you would not know from talking to her. She is so quick and witty and funny and brilliant, and I felt so honoured that she gave up her time to speak to me, because obviously she's 91, she doesn't need to bother to talk to me. So this new book has come out, and especially if you're struggling with like reading a big novel at the moment, I'd really recommend it, because it's just like these lovely short vignettes that are so well written, and I really loved it. Hilma came in to talk to me about her husband Morty, who passed away from COVID at the start of the pandemic last year. Are you in Brooklyn at the moment, Hilma?
No, I haven't been in Brooklyn for years. I live in Manhattan now. I'm still in New York City, but I'm in Manhattan.
That's a real New York answer that you were like, oh no, I'm not in Brooklyn, I'm in Manhattan. Like, you're still in New York right now. So thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it. You have a beautiful new book out at the moment, which is a collection of your old works and a more recent story. I thought that the writing is incredible. It's really, and it's really interesting to read a writer develop, you know, because you start with your very famous essay, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket, which was written in
55 years ago.
And we end with a much more a recent story written last year. And it's absolutely fascinating. So congratulations on that, on your new book. So Hilma, we ask everybody this. Who are we remembering today?
We're remembering two people. My husband, Morten Wolitzer, and my father, Abraham Liebman.
And did you want to start with your husband, Morty?
Yes.
So how did Morty die? What happened?
He died of COVID at the very beginning of the pandemic. We both came down with it. He came down with it first. I caught it. We were hospitalized, but in separate hospitals. So we never saw each other again. He died 2 days before I was released. And we were married. You know, we had a great privilege. We were married for 68 years, and not many people get that many years together. Yeah. So we were very fortunate. And it was the circumstances of his death that were the hardest to take, because it was as if he had vanished. We never saw each other. You read all the obituaries, and they say the person was surrounded by loved ones. Well, there were no loved ones there because of the pandemic. He was not allowed any visitors. I was in the hospital. I was not allowed any visitors. And after he died, there were none of the usual rituals of mourning. There was no funeral. There was no getting together of the family afterward to see one another. I came home from when I was released from the hospital, and I said he had died 2 days before. His shoes were still next to the bed. And his glasses were his reading glasses. He had a number of pair of drugstore reading glasses, and a pair of them was still on the bed as well. And it was really hard to come to terms with his not being there. And I think that I wrote the story, finally, as a way of grieving and as a way of putting it down on paper, made me see what really happened, made me examine it, accept it, and find some peace.
Oh, Hilma, I can't... Yeah. We've been talking a lot about the past year on this show. And the phrase that I heard very early on, which has stuck with me, is the phrase that anybody who was suffering a bereavement at this time was suffering trauma on top of trauma. Because as we know on this show, if you experience a death, you know, in normal times, inverted commas, it's very traumatic, it's very difficult. But to experience it when, as you said, all your rituals are taken from you, you can't hold someone's hand, you can't say goodbye, it's an added layer of trauma on top of what you had to deal with. And yeah, so did he die, was it in March when it kind of hit in New York?
No, he came down with it at the very end of March and died in April. He was home for a few days with it and didn't tell me he didn't feel well. And then I heard him coughing. And then he suddenly couldn't stand up. And I had to call 911 for an emergency ambulance. And they came. And at that point, as I said in the stories, and this is the most autobiographical story I've ever written, I usually protect our privacy more, and I'm usually, though there are invented details in the story, and I assign it all to fictional characters, it is what really happened to us. And he didn't feel well, and he couldn't stand up, and they came, and they put him on a gurney, and they put an oxygen mask over his face, and they began shouting at me to get his phone, to get his pajamas, to get his glasses and so forth. I couldn't find matching pajamas. I mean, and that seemed important to me, stupidly enough. It's the details that get you in the end. And I remember running after the gurney down the hallway. We live in a high rise. And they rang for the elevator. And when the elevator came and he was gone, the elevator door closed, I realized I never said goodbye or I love you or anything. I said it afterward, and it was too late. He was gone. And so in writing it, I really felt as if I had made the surreal real. And I was able to... I was very sad. I was walking around the house weeping at unexpected moments, like in the shower. And, of course, we were still in isolation. We were still in lockdown. And for quite a while after that, in fact, I had his clothes here for over a year before my grandsons were inoculated and could come and help me, both physically and emotionally, to dispose of them. So that was very hard. But, you know, someone asked, how did you deal with writing the story? I said, it would have been harder not to write the story. It was painful, but it was also cathartic.
You get that sense reading it that you're someone who writes through things. And I think not everybody has that brain, if that makes sense, that they need to write through an experience. And I think that's a true testament of a writer, that everything that you are, that all your input is collaborated inside and then needs to come out, you know, through a keyboard, through writing, through a pen. And you get that sense from reading it, that it is the wife character in the story is slowly processing what the fuck just happened to her.
Yeah, it paralleled what was happening to me and what had happened to him. And truthfully, I hadn't written fiction for a very long time, and I thought I had retired from writing fiction. We were both 90 years old. We were having a very nice, companionable old age. I was writing a poem occasionally, but I wasn't writing any stories. I hadn't done them for years. And I couldn't believe how my fingers flew on the keyboard. I almost couldn't type as quickly as the story was coming to me. And wow. I knew that I had to write it down.
Yeah, you get that sense reading it. It has that sense of urgency about it. And I think especially for, you know, all of us who have lived through the past year and a half, I think we can all relate to that horrific panic that we all had of not knowing what the situation was, not knowing what anything meant, not knowing what going to hospital meant. And it must have been so frightening for you to have him, like, as you say, whisked away from you and then you having to go to a different hospital. Were you able to communicate with him at all while you were in?
Yes, we did.
Hospital?
We spoke to each other at night, as I say in the story. And there was a doctor who called me every night to report on him and called my children as well. He was just a wonderful young doctor. And the thing he actually said to me, which was so heartbreaking, I couldn't put it into the story. He asked me to call him, and my children kept reminding me to do it. And I said, I'm just not emotionally prepared to speak to him. And the kids kept saying, well, he won't remember who you are because there's one COVID case after another, and the obituaries were full of COVID cases. So I finally called him, and I said, I hope you'll remember me. I hope you remember my husband. He said, oh, he said, I will carry him in my heart throughout my practice. And it almost sounded too corny to put in the story, though it moved me tremendously when he said it.
Yeah, that's one of those where life is too corny to be fictionalized.
Right, you have to make it tougher.
In real life, that's like beautiful. In a story, you're like, oh, come on, that wouldn't have happened. But that's so wonderful that doctor was able to communicate that you had somebody, because my God, what they must have been going through at that time, all of those people working, the frontline workers, it must have just been, well, it's possible to imagine, and it's not pleasant to imagine.
Do you know that every night, I don't know if you did this in London, but in New York City, every night at a particular time, everybody in the street would cheer the medical workers. Just this huge cheer would go up in the street, and I opened my windows to hear it because it was very heartening.
Yeah, we had every Thursday we would clap for carers. So every Thursday you'd open your window at 8 o'clock and everyone would bang their pans and
that's
whoop
just
and
what
cheer.
This was like, yes.
Yeah.
And I have to say, one thing that happened with my husband, speaking of clapping, was the night before he died in the middle of the night. This was Friday. I found out I was going out of the hospital on Monday. Somebody told him about it. He could no longer speak, but he clapped.
Oh, Hilma.
Yeah, that was really pretty heavy. That was hard for me to think about.
Yeah, that's a very beautiful and sad thing at exactly the same time. How was it when you described not having these rituals? How did you cope that in the initial aftermath of a death, which is always a very difficult time, but is normally filled with people and rituals? And, you know, normally people complain like, oh, I couldn't get rid of people. Everyone's coming around. But you were in this completely opposite, you know, through the looking glass world where you were on your own.
Yeah, I was completely on my own. And I was glad that my children had spouses and my grandchildren as well, so that they had somebody with them. I realized that I didn't share a meal with anybody for more than a year. So I would always take a book to the table, the thing my mother would say was very rude to do, but I was all alone, so nobody could criticize me.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think you're allowed to do that in that circumstance. Do you feel like you were able to process the grief? Or did you feel like, because it was just you, you know, it's just in your head? How was it?
I couldn't until I wrote the story, actually. It was very hard. I kept thinking I would hear his footsteps. I would hear his key. I, you know, he would He would say something to me. And in the story, I compare it, well, I talk about Houdini dying and wanting, he and his wife wanting to make contact after one of them died. And I, of course, I didn't believe anymore. It turned out that Houdini couldn't contact his wife after he died, no matter how many seances she had on his birthday. But I found myself watching a ball game. We were both very big baseball fans for the New York Mets, who were losing horribly at the time. But I would find myself lying only on my side of the bed. I never moved to his side of the bed, but I would find myself, after there was a home run or a terrible error, I would turn and say, "Did you see that?" And I really forgot for a split second that he wasn't there to answer me.
Yeah, I mean, of course, after that long of someone being a part of your life, I mean, I always compare it to when you start going out with someone, it takes a while to get used to them being in your life. And when someone dies, it takes a while to get used to them not being there. You know, people leave indentations in us, and it doesn't just stop being like, oh, they're gone. You know, you all those, like you said, those rituals of speaking to them and those things you did together, it's, you have to then do them by yourself. And that's so difficult. And I can't imagine what you went through having to do it alone without support. When were you able to go out and see people? Or were you being very careful, I'm assuming, after what had happened to you as well? Like, when
Well,
did you
somebody came to help me out through an agency, because I was still very weak after the COVID. So she came, and unfortunately, she caught COVID from another person she was seeing. So I had to be quarantined even longer, and then I was on my own. The building I live in, the people who service the building I live in were just wonderful. I could put my trash outside. They would leave my mail outside. And as I said in the story, I would just open the peephole just to see somebody human going down the hallway, just to see another person walking down the hallway. It took a very long time. And then we finally went outside, and my family gathered in the street. I have a photograph of it. Everyone more than 6 feet apart, waving at each other, throwing kisses and so forth through the mask. It was very bizarre. But then now I'm triple vaccinated. My kids are vaccinated and they can come. My daughter is here and is going to make a wonderful dinner for me tonight. So I won't be reading a book at the table.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm really glad that some sense of support network has been able to come back to you, because I just, yeah, I can't imagine how difficult it's been. What did you do about funerals? Did you kind of postpone stuff, or are you still waiting?
He was cremated, and no one saw him off. So that was another thing. And one of my older daughter has the ashes. I just haven't dealt with that at all. But I did, on the first anniversary of his death, hold a Zoom memorial service for him. It probably took me a year to figure out how to do Zoom, because I seem to have forgotten that I didn't have a touch screen, and I began poking my screen desperately and couldn't get anything to happen. But we did have a Zoom memorial, and because he loved jazz so much, we played some jazz music and showed photographs, and my kids and several friends spoke wonderfully about him. They spoke about his absence, and they spoke about his presence in their lives. And it was really very heartening. That was and I didn't even really believe in the rituals before this. I didn't know, you know, I didn't see how they helped at all. But I realized just being in the company of others and touching one another, holding hands or hugging someone. Even now we sort of mime a hug, even though we're vaccinated, we hug with our faces turned away. I have to say that there was a male nurse in hospital who came to tell me that my husband had died. And, or maybe my daughter called, I can't even remember at this point. Maybe I knew already and he had just found out. But he came in and he put his arms around me. And I'll never forget that. That was so brave of him, first of all. I mean, we were masked, but still, I was actively ill. And it was just a wonderful gesture. So people were terrific. And also, I felt isolated, but I didn't feel totally alone, because the whole world was going through this.
Yeah, that's true.
2 weeks before my husband died, my daughter's mother-in-law died of COVID.
Oh, wow.
So it was bang, bang. But it was happening to so many people. And everybody seemed to really care about each other in a way that I didn't remember since World War II, when I remember that kind of caring for one's neighbor. And it was quite moving to me.
I think we're still processing what just happened.
And it's still happening.
And it's still happening. Yeah, it hasn't gone. And I think, that sense of, we definitely had that in London, that sense of deep care, as you said, you know, neighbours really caring for each other, like really go, just the small little gestures that people were really reaching out to each other to be like, you're not alone, I'm here, like I can help you. And it was really heartening to see that. It was really heartening. But I think the rituals is really interesting. I knew the rituals were important, but it wasn't until they all went that I began to see, as you said, like quite what those rituals, how they were holding us together. And if you'd asked me before, I would have said, oh, a funeral is very important because we all need to remember that person. I wouldn't have said, oh, you need to hug people, you need to hold their hat, like, because that's something we had never lost. So,
and you also had to see it happening so that you could believe it, so that you could process it and believe it and go on. I think you have to grieve before you can accept it. And this bizarreness, this weirdness of the situation interfered with actually believing it for a while. And as I said, when I wrote it down, it made it real.
Yeah, and that's interesting because what you're describing is often what I've heard children say who lost a parent and they weren't allowed to see it or be at the funeral. So maybe, for example, they lost a parent in the 1970s and they were kept away from it and they would say, oh, I didn't believe it. It was like it hadn't happened. And I think, you know, we're hitting again how important it is to see somebody, to be there, to hold a hand, to see a dead body, for your something in your brain to go, this is real. Like,
exactly.
And of course that interrupts your grieving because a part of your brain is thinking, well, maybe they're just gone to the shops, maybe they're just gonna come back. It's very difficult to get your brain around somebody dying, especially so quickly and in the middle of such chaos,
right? And not of anything you would ever expect your loved one to die of.
Yeah,
I mean, we had five cancers between us that we had survived, and we're doing very well, really feeling well. And so for this to have happened was just bizarre. But as I said, we did have 68 years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny, isn't it, with grief? It doesn't stop things being painful.
No.
But it's still something, it's still a beautiful thing that you had 68 years together. But yeah, I mean, I think we all had that strange sense of, I at the moment can't stop looking at photos from like December 2019, you know, when we didn't know, and we all look so, we look different, we look innocent. There's like just, and I think, gosh, if I could have paused and told that person there's going to be a global pandemic, you won't be able to leave your house, I would have laughed. I would have, no, because it was the realms of, you know, Hollywood movies. It wasn't anything any of us could conceive would ever happen.
Everybody's lovely naked face without a mask.
Yes. Or in the house, or standing near each other, hugging each other with no...
Yes.
Yeah, no, like, oh, gosh, yeah, it's really strange. It's terribly... I mean, what you've been through, Hilma, is, yeah, very, very difficult. And I'm glad that you were able to have that Zoom memorial. I think stuff like that, like you said, even if it is on Zoom, even if it is not still not quite normal, I think, as you said, it to allow to be around people who loved the person as you did is very important.
It was very important. I realized afterward how much better I felt for having done it. Sad during it and better afterwards.
Yeah.
It was funny, comforting.
Yeah, like you said, not realizing what a ritual can do until it's done. And then being like, oh, that's why funerals exist. Yeah. That's why they've been around for millennia, because something in us needs to say goodbye properly.
Now I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. And when you were writing the story, how did it feel when it was out in the world? Did it just feel cathartic, or did you feel like, oh gosh, there's my grief out in the world? Like, how do I feel about that?
No, I didn't feel that I exposed anything really private or secret or deeply private about it, because I assigned it to fictional characters and because I put in so many invented details. And I refer to it as the truth wrapped in a lie, which is, I guess, a definition of fiction anyway, because there's an intrinsic truth, but not necessarily a personal truth in it. Mm. This did have a lot of the details were recognizable to my family.
What did your family say when you said, I'm going to write this down?
Well, first of all, my younger daughter, Meg, who's a wonderful novelist and a wonderful daughter, came up with the idea for the collection in the first place. I came out of hospital and I was sad and sick, and she had been reading these stories and said, Mom, I think you ought to have a collection. And I wasn't the least bit interested at first. But as time went on, I realized I had to do something besides grieve. And I had to have something to look forward to. Even at 91, you need something to look forward to. And suddenly I became involved in it. And it was a very big process. I forgot that how difficult it is to put a book together.
Yeah.
Even one that you've mostly written already. I had to find the proper order for the stories. I had to reread the stories and look for repetitions, because the stories were published separately. And writers tend to have particular tics, words they repeat. And so I had to make sure that they didn't cross over from story to story. And then I had the new story. And the new story was the longest story in the book, I think. And I had to do that, too. And then I had to get all these, what they call passes, that you get from the publisher. They keep sending you, and you have to look for it for errors and for things you might want to change. And both of my daughters were reading them along with me in their respective homes and helping me. So my kids were really terrifically helpful. And I became very distracted by this process. Mm-hmm. I wasn't particularly looking forward to publication. But it has been a very good experience here and where you are as well. I mean, the response in the UK has just been thrilling.
That's so wonderful. I'm so glad. I mean, the stories are beautiful. They really are. And they're funny. And they're really, you know, and I do a comedy show, which is based on Jane Austen. And we dress up in Regency gear and we improvise a Jane Austen show.
Can I download that?
Yes, you can. I'll send you the link.
I'd love to.
But it reminded me of Jane Austen. It reminded me of, you know, that kind of minutiae and detail of, you know, a female point of view that often gets overlooked and those things that women do notice. And I just thought, this book is so brilliant. I was like, I loved it. And, you know, yeah, the news story is, it's really heartbreaking, but I think especially for this time, it's cathartic as a reader, because you can recognize a lot of those feelings of panic and grief that we've all been through, even if you haven't experienced something as tragic as you have been through. It's a really beautiful book. I mean, yeah, I'm so pleased for you that in the midst of something so awful, there was a distraction, because you deserve it.
Like, thank you. And I have to say that Jane Austen gave me permission to write about domesticity, about the household life. It was what I knew. I often say I was raised by a housewife to be a housewife. I had no particular career. I didn't go to college. And so reading Jane Austen, and of course the second wave of feminism helped too, but I began to see that it was legitimate to write about domestic life, that really domestic life was important, and it became a valid literary subject.
And you get that's why it were, yeah, I get that sense in your stories. I was reading them and I thought, oh, this is like Austen, where it's so familiar that it takes you a second to recognize quite how skillful it is to pick up on the domesticity, because you're like, oh yeah, the supermarket, yeah, oh, I know this world. But obviously I know that world, because equally, you know, I live in the domestic quite heavily, and I have two kids and a husband and all the other trappings of domestic life. And it's my other death and Jane Austen. I have to be careful I don't start doing the Jane Austen podcast. Hilma, did you want to talk about your dad a little bit? So yes. His name was Abraham.
Yes, and he was 6 weeks shy of 100 when he died.
That is incredible.
Unfortunately, he was suffering from dementia.
Okay, yeah.
And he was bedridden, and he developed gangrene in his leg. And the doctor said they must remove the leg, they must amputate the leg. And I said, oh, must you really? I mean, I don't want him to go through that. And he said, well, the pain of gangrene is worse than the pain of amputation, and he won't even know what happened to him anyway, which he didn't. But it happened, and then 8 days later, he died. And he was a practicing Orthodox Jew, and I had to call his rabbi, with whom he'd been connected for a number of years. The rabbi was fairly elderly himself. I had to call and make arrangements for the funeral, for a graveside service. And I told the rabbi everything that had happened, and he said to me, where's the leg? And I thought, oh my, you know, I'd been taking care of, both of my parents had dementia, and I'd been helping them as much as I could for several years. And even though I loved them deeply, I also felt relieved that they were out of this kind of psychic agony, and I was, and selfishly, I was now free, but I wasn't. I had to locate my father's leg. It seems that in Jewish law, you must be buried. All of you must be buried.
All of you, right.
The leg had to be buried too. So I called the hospital where my father died, and I said what I needed, and they put me in touch with the head of nursing. And I said, I began to talk to her about it, and unfortunately I began to laugh, and I couldn't stop. And it was so embarrassing. But to look for a leg, it just seemed absolutely ludicrous. And she was quite serious, though. She said, I'm terribly sorry. You should have been asked if you wanted to have the leg cremated, buried, or disposed of. And she said, we disposed of it, and I can't have it. I can't find it for you. So I had to call the rabbi back, and I said, look, my father was a devoted congregant of yours, and if he and my mother were meant to dance in heaven, God will give him another leg, won't he? And he did preside at the graveside service, and he was quite wonderful. And that's the story of my father's missing leg. We will never know where it went. He went in one direction, and the leg went in another. And
oh my goodness!
And this is why there's often something very funny at the edge of darkness.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, how can you not laugh?
Right. I mean, and it's it's a saving grace when you're really upset about something to find something funny in a sad situation. Yeah. It really helps you get through it.
Yeah, that's really good. That's a really good story. I'm sorry that it's true. It's just that
sounds like a Sherlock Holmes mystery, doesn't it?
Or
a Nancy Drew mystery, the case of the missing leg.
The missing leg. Oh my goodness. So how old were you when your father died?
Well, I was already on Medicare. We were all on Social Security at the same time. It was insane. He was 27 when I was born.
Oh, so you were 73?
Yes.
Wow.
And that's why it was pretty embarrassing. When my father died, this is another thing that happened. I got to the hospital late because I'd gone to the library. And when I went to his room, I realized he had died. The bed was empty and there was a black rubber sheet on it, which almost seemed symbolic. Mm. And I spoke to the nurse. I said, "Did my father die?" And she said, "Yes. Please go into the waiting room at the end of the hall and someone will come and speak to you about it." And so I went in and there were three lovely women sitting there whose sister was dying, and they were middle-aged women. And I came in and I burst into tears. And they jumped up and they put their arms around me, which was just so wonderful. And then they said, "Would you like us to pray for him?" And I felt they meant, you know, some other time. But they meant right then. And they formed a circle with my hands too. And they begged Jesus to take my father home, which was another thing. And I'm thinking, oh, my father is turning over down in that mortuary. But
oh my gosh.
I have to say that I felt tremendous. I didn't tell the rabbi this part of the story.
No.
But I felt tremendously comforted by those women. My heart was really lifted by them and how kind they were. And it was a little startling, but it was still a great experience in the middle of a bad experience.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. I mean, it's funny because it's just a funny that immediately some Christians found you and got Jesus involved. That's just funny. But yeah, it is beautiful that their instant reaction was to care and to be kind to you. And as you said, like, when you lose someone, it's full of these moments of surrealness and bizarreness and sadness and funniness. And that's partly why I started the show, was that when my dad died, there were so many experiences like that were so weird and funny. And then
and you were a child.
I was 15, yeah, so I was young.
Such a tender age to lose a parent.
Yeah, it's not great.
No.
It's definitely not great. But that's one of the reasons, yeah, I wanted this show to exist, for a place where we could admit these things, because I felt like so many people were like, "Oh, you know, I don't want to say, but this quite funny thing happened."
Right.
And I feel like we should all admit, like, death is not, you know, angels don't descend and you don't instantly become very sincere and serious if that's not who you are as a person. You know, it's real. Like, stuff gets spilt and people say the wrong things and it's embarrassing and funny and sad and silly at exactly the same time.
There's no right thing to say. And
no.
I feel sorry for people who try to express it. I don't get angry with anybody for saying the wrong thing, because I don't think there is a wrong thing. I have to say too that you'd think that those women would have started laughing when this 73-year-old woman comes in crying about her dying father. I mean, they could have said, "My goodness, was he Methuselah?" I mean, and instead they put their arms around me and prayed for him.
Yeah,
which is just an amazing story, I think.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. And I think any experience we have where you get that human connection with someone who doesn't need to give it to you, you know, isn't your relation or your loved one, and it's just, as we were talking about before during the pandemic, of just people being kind for the sake of being kind, is so heartwarming, because so much of our life is a, you know, this kind of rat race of against each other and not helping people and who can get there the fastest and just get out my way. And whenever there is that connection, you're reminded of like, oh, we're all the same. We're all just people trying to make the best choices, and sometimes we get it wrong.
We're all stuck in the human condition, and here we are. And yeah. And we have to have a sense of humor about it. So I'm so glad you're doing something funny about sad things.
Well, I'm glad there's some funny stories that happen. But yeah, thank you. I just wondered as well, what do you think, if this is an okay question to ask, what do you think Morty would have made of you writing the story? Have you considered that?
He liked my work very much, and I think he was very proud of me, and I think he would want to have been remembered. I mean, everyone wants to be remembered in some way. Life is so fragile, and it seems very short, even though I've lived a very long time. I'm heading toward 92 in January, and yet I feel that I've only been here for an afternoon, you know. A long afternoon, but an afternoon. But I think he would have been happy to be remembered in that way. And also the memorial service, the playing of the jazz music that he loved. He played sax and clarinet, and my younger grandson has taken his saxophone at last. My feet were resting on it when I was at the computer all the time. It was under my desk. And I'm happy that my grandson has it now, and that one grandson has his watch and things that belong to him. And I think he loved them so much that he would be happy for them to have them as well. It's hard to know what someone would have wanted. Mm. We didn't really discuss that very much, but like the man in the story, he did opt not to have any heroic measures. Mm. And because he had so many comorbidities, he didn't have a real shot at surviving it. Mm. And I'm surprised I did at 90. I mean, that's sort of miraculous. Yeah. I feel if my father was Methuselah, I was Lazarus. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, your work is not done. That's what it feels like.
Not done yet. I feel I want to write more stories about Paulette, whose life seems, even though I don't use that many details of my own life except in this story, many aspects of their lives paralleled ours. They're getting married, they're having children, the usual struggles and joys of married life. And now I'm thinking, Paulette, who's only 90, she's not 91, I made her somewhat different from me, is now living alone, and what about her independence? I treasure my independence. My kids say, well, can't you get someone in to help you? I said, I don't want anybody in here. You know, I think of Philip Larkin writing about the old fools. Don't they know it when the strangers come? And that has stayed with me. So I'm thinking that Paulette, my fictional character, would be worried that her children are going to force her into assisted living if she takes a fall, if she forgets to turn the oven off, or if she puts the sponge inside the refrigerator. I mean, I worry every day. I'm alone, and every night I check everything. I check that I've locked the door, that I've shut off every faucet and the oven. I make sure the refrigerator is closed. It's really important. And it's not something that my husband and I did blithely when we were only 89 or 90. We just took it for granted that everything would be done properly.
I really hope you do continue, Hilma. I think you should. Like, you know, it's so interesting to hear that perspective from somebody who can write it down and can, you know, has the writerly brain, thinks in that way, and can offer us that perspective, because I don't think it's a voice we often hear, because often someone that age isn't able to write it down anymore for various reasons. So I sincerely hope, you know, we hear more about Paulette, because I love Paulette.
Thank you.
I love her. I was like,
I feel as if she's an old friend. And I say, I have great curiosity about what happened to her. And the only way I can find out is to write about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hilma, do. And I really loved at the beginning of the book, you know, the dedication, just saying Morty. I just thought that was so beautiful. And I feel like, you have offered a way to remember him when that was completely taken from you in this completely unusual, you know, once in a century situation. And I'm just glad that you found the strength to do that, because I think it will help a lot of people as well to read that story. And as you said, it's a truth wrapped up in a lie, but my God, that's how we learn so many things. That's how we understand ourselves and the human condition. So yeah, I want to know what happens next.
Me too. Do it. Tune in.
Yeah. Well, Hilma, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it, and for remembering Morty and Abraham.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow Hilma on Twitter at Hilma, H-I-L-M-A, Wolitzer, W-O-L-I-T-Z-E-R. And her book, Today a Woman Went Mad in a Supermarket, is available to buy now and is absolutely brilliant. I thoroughly recommend it. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely. Hilma was in New York, I was in London. It was edited by Kate Holland in London. The music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. The artwork is by Jade Perkin. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.